And also a good morning to you. I'll give you a couple of minutes to get yourselves prepared. Each of you has been here before too, although it's been some time. We're going back to the rules of appellate procedure, including the standing rule. I don't know what you're using for timers on the separate podiums. Apparently there is none, so I will just alert you if you're not aware of what the time component is. And Mr. Knapp, we were surprised you didn't have a student in tow, but that's fine. We have the pleasure of hearing from you. So whenever you're ready, go ahead and approach the podium closest to you, not the middle one.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Good morning. My name is Peter Knapp. I'm here this morning on behalf of the relator, Janine Slonim. Ms. Slonim is asking this court to reverse Deed's determination that she committed employment misconduct because, as a matter of law, the record in this case does not sustain or support that determination. And this is true for two reasons. The first is this: there's no evidence in the record that she committed any infraction in a negligent manner, a requirement for a finding of misconduct. And second, the evidence that is present in the record is exclusively evidence that is hearsay that would not be admissible in a judicial proceeding, and as such, it violates the residual rule. Ms. Slonim worked
for— Do we have any case law that applies the residual rule to this context, an unemployment case?
In an unemployment case, no, we do not.
And
we do, there is a precedential Court of Appeals case that applies it to agencies, and it does not, by its terms, limit that. It's based upon articulation of the rule at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court drew that rule from common law and did not limit it to particular agencies, but I have not seen a case that applies or refuses to apply the rule in an employment context.
So does it matter? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, as I understand it, Weiss, is that how you pronounce the name of the HR person?
I believe so.
Attended the Loudermill hearing, and your client testified at that hearing and made some admissions against interest at that hearing.
Well,
And so my question to you then, when Weiss testifies or gives testimony in front of the ULJ, is that hearsay based on her having heard those admissions against interest?
What my client testified to was she admitted that she was out of compliance for a period of time with the requirement to be wearing a face shield.
Well, and also that she may have forgotten to document some of the cares that she provided.
That's true, and that is also something that happened at the Loudermill hearing. Two points about that, Your Honor. And the first is this. Ms. Slonim came to work on the morning of December 23rd, and her 12-year career at the VA ended to her very suddenly and very surprisingly. And that Loudermill hearing took place approximately 45 minutes after she received that letter of termination. Second,
but that did follow two suspensions, right?
There had been, she'd worked there for 12 years. There were two previous incidents of employment discipline that fall of 2020, followed by apparently this October 20th incident that same fall.
But when she had the first two incidents, they were within like a week of each other, weren't they?
That's correct, Judge. And the point here is Ms. Weiss also testified that it was the failure to comply with the PPE requirements that led to this final incident being the triggering incident for termination, and that's significant. The problem with this case, and it presents, I think, a very unusual set of circumstances for an unemployment case, is a finding of misconduct should not be based exclusively upon hearsay evidence like the hearsay evidence.
How much does it matter that she didn't object to the hearsay testimony?
Well, two points on that, Your Honor. First is we did object to the violation of the residual rule once it became apparent that the judge had based a finding of negligence and a finding of misconduct exclusively on hearsay evidence not admissible in a judicial proceeding. We did that in the request for reconsideration. We presented to that ULJ the same arguments that are being presented to this court, and the ULJ affirmed that decision. Second, Ms. Weiss's testimony was not objectionable. We're not here today to tell you that somehow the ULJ should have excluded that testimony. It was fine to admit it under the department's own rule. It was fine for the ULJ to rely on it. The department's correct in their brief. There are many instances where hearsay evidence, including hearsay evidence that would not be admissible in a judicial proceeding, is introduced at an unemployment hearing and relied upon. But there needs to be and should be a limit on the basis of that reliance.
And well, what should the limit
be? There is.
Right. What should, I mean, this seems like you're asking us to apply the residual rule for the first time here. What rule would you have this court adopt?
Asking the court to issue a precedential opinion that, as its central syllabus point states simply, that the Department of Employment and Economic Development cannot base a finding of misconduct exclusively upon hearsay evidence that would not be admissible in a judicial proceeding. And we're asking...
back to what Wise heard your client say at the Loudermill hearing, I don't know that it was based solely on hearsay evidence.
My client admitted at this hearing that there was a period of time when she wasn't in compliance with the rule. She offered an explanation for that. Ms. Weiss said that wasn't an explanation she heard at the Loudermill hearing. But that alone isn't enough to constitute misconduct, and that alone didn't seem, at least according-
The hearing judge could say that, point out as was here, that that was inconsistent, I don't want to say inconsistent testimony, but it was, you know, obviously, that's an important factor that likely would have been brought up at the Loudermill hearing.
To be honest, I think it would have been if my client had not been so taken by surprise and the Loudermill hearing hadn't occurred 45 minutes after she'd received that letter of termination.
Is that how they work? I don't know.
That's how it happened in this case, but I'm not here as an expert on state employment practice. There's a lot that the employer could have done. The course of this hearing, Ms. Weiss refers at different times to an investigation that took place or notes that she had from an investigation that she apparently doesn't have access to. That investigation report was never submitted as evidence. It's likely, it seems from her testimony, that there would have been an incident report. That incident report was never offered into evidence. Both of those would have been business records, and both of them would have been admissible in a judicial proceeding. They didn't show up in the record here. And the ULJ in this case understood that was a problem. And that's why during the course of the hearing, the ULJ said, I need to hear from a nursing supervisor, someone that was there that day. Ms. Weiss apparently, during the course of the hearing, made arrangements to have that supervisor who had direct knowledge of the incident in question contacted so that she could testify. At the end of the hearing, really just minutes before it concluded, the ULJ said, is she prepared to testify? Ms. Weiss said yes, gave the judge a telephone number, and no one picked up. Any of that evidence, had the judge come to the same conclusion based on those reports or based on that testimony, might well have been sufficient to support a finding of misconduct. And if I were standing here in front of you, I wouldn't be making this same argument, that's for sure. But none of that happened. And that is an unusual set of occurrences in an unemployment case. And I think the department's own brief, that string cite of cases they have, illustrates that. When I first got the department's brief, I read through each of those cases to assure myself that there hadn't been a case that this court had issued, even a non-precedential case, that said the residual rule wasn't applicable or had dealt with the residual rule in the context of an unemployment case. And I was fairly certain that was true. But I assured myself that it was. None of those cases deal expressly with this point. But in preparation for today, I went back through each of those cases as well as the reported cases that are cited. And one of the things that struck me was that in each of those cases, employers came forward with evidence that was non-hearsay evidence that was relied upon in those cases, or if hearsay evidence, was evidence that would have been admissible in a judicial proceeding. And thinking about that, of course, that makes sense. Employers have a strong incentive to bring evidence to these hearings.
Well, let's say we agree with that and hearsay was incorrect. Your client did testify, and her story, her theory was that somehow the mask got flipped off. Didn't we have credibility findings as to whether or not that was testimony that was believable?
Absolutely. The judge chose not to believe my client.
Why would that be enough then? Because that would certainly be a violation. You have a population at the VA that, well, much like other populations, that it's extremely vulnerable. I mean, these are significant things, not to have a face shield on or goggles or whatever the PPE may be.
2 points, Your Honor. The first is this. My client did testify to an explanation, and the ULJ was free to disbelieve that explanation. But we're still left wondering how this happened, when it happened, the context in which it happened. And not only were we wondering about that.
But she said so, it happened. I mean, that's what I'm getting at. Relator said it happened, and this is how it happened. And the judge said, well, that's unbelievable, not credible.
Well,
so it happened.
If you we don't know, and neither did the ULJ. And if you take a look at Mrs. Weiss's testimony, one of the things that she says near the very end of the hearing is, I didn't hear that, or I don't believe I heard that, from Ms. Slonim at the Loudermill hearing, and that's something we would have taken into account. I think it's a reasonable inference to draw from her statement that the simple fact that someone was momentarily out of compliance through no fault of their own would not constitute a breach of the policy. But more to the point, more than a simple breach of the policy is necessary to constitute misconduct. The employer, of course, is free, subject to the strictures of contract or other provisions of law, to fire Ms. Slonim for that reason, any reason at all, or no reason whatsoever. But that's not the definition of misconduct. For that infraction to be misconduct, we have to have some evidence of negligence. Here, it appears that the judge presumed negligence.
And what kind of evidence would you have had to have? I understand that the reports that, of course, were not offered as exhibits said that, in fact, some of the nursing staff had observed multiple times on that day where your client was not wearing the face shield. But setting that aside, what evidence of negligence do you propose would be necessary?
I think any evidence of negligence would have been better than what we have. We don't know who observed her, how many times she was observed, the situations in which she was observed, whether there were two nursing staff members who observed the same incident. We don't know how it happened. But we can't presume negligence. I'm not aware of a res ipsa case in an unemployment setting. But the application of presumed negligence to this situation would clearly be inappropriate. We've lived through long enough parts of this pandemic to know that there have been times when probably every single person in this room has suddenly found themselves unmasked or not in compliance with a directive about protective equipment through no fault of our own. Last week I was teaching a class, I was supposed to be masked. The strap on my mask snapped suddenly.
Well, you didn't work in a healthcare setting, and you know that isn't that different also?
The importance of compliance may be different, but the fact of negligence and the need for proof of negligence remains the same. This is the kind of infraction that can happen for reasons other than individual negligence. And while the ULJ
if you testified. If this was you, and you testified that the band came off and it snapped, and then a couple of weeks later you had some other incident that was beyond your control, I mean, doesn't that belie then a claim that this was due to circumstances that that just occurred, just happened?
I'm not challenging the ALJ's right to disbelieve my client's explanation.
Boy, that's pretty much darn bad luck.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that we do have any evidence that there were a series of situations in which she was out of compliance. The record is, I think, confusing at best about that. But the other piece to keep in mind is, in order to presume negligence under standard res ipsa doctrine, you'd also have to show that my client was in exclusive control. And even though the judge didn't believe the story that my client offered to explain what had happened, I was working with patients in the Alzheimer's ward, and one of them, unfamiliar with who I was, knocked that mask off of my face. Nobody said something like that could never happen. That's not just bad luck. That is a recognized hazard in working with these patients.
Understood.
And as my client testified, this was the first time she'd worked with that particular group of patients.
Time has wound down. Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal, of course.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development. First, I'd like to note that the ULJ here found that Relator was discharged for three reasons, and that two of these reasons were employment misconduct. That's failure to provide care to residents and failure to wear the PPE on the date in question. And to reverse the decision here and find Relator eligible, the court would need to find that neither of these reasons are employment misconduct. And Relator here is not challenging the ULJ's decision that failing to provide cares to resident was employment misconduct. So any argument on that point is waived, and the court should affirm the decision on that basis alone. Moving on to the arguments about hearsay. Minnesota Rule 3310.2922 addresses evidence in unemployment benefits proceedings. And that rule states that an unemployment law judge is not bound by statutory and common law rules of evidence. So the residuum rule here is a common law rule of evidence that this court has never applied in an unemployment benefits case.
But there is a requirement that it be reasonable to rely on the hearsay. And doesn't the fact that the ULJ asked for and attempted to reach one of the nurses who did have first-person knowledge of what happened on that October 20th date, I mean, doesn't that support Slonim's argument that a reasonable decision-maker wouldn't have relied exclusively on hearsay?
No. I mean, the ULJ was trying to develop the record the best she could and get the best evidence that she could get on that point. But the evidence that she has is sufficient to support it. It is reliable. It meets that test for reliability in the rule. And then ULJ talks about how it's reliable. She finds Wise's testimony credible. She explains that it was detailed, that she testified about the circumstances of the PPE incident, you know, who saw it. She named who saw it. She testified about statements in the investigation. She testified about statements in the hearing. So the ULJ does go through those steps of showing that this is reliable evidence. And not only does she just rely on the hearsay, she also finds that the relator's testimony is not credible, and she explains why the testimony is not credible. So it's not just looking at that hearsay in a vacuum. The judge also, you know, analyzes whether Weiss's testimony is credible and reliable, and also reasons that the relator's testimony is not credible. So it is a sufficient basis. The fact that she did try to get a hold of the nurse, I think, shows that she was trying to get the best evidence she could. I would also note that the relator didn't object to the hearsay in the hearing, nor did the relator request to subpoena the RN team lead. And at the beginning of the hearing, the judge did inform relator that she has the right to request a continuance and to request a subpoena for evidence or testimony. And she could have done that in the hearing, and the judge would have then addressed that request to reschedule, subpoena the team lead. The judge made the decision in the hearing that she didn't need to do that.
But how is the relator, given the fact there's no discovery or anything in these cases, they're expedited matters, how is the relator to know that employer representative will come and talk about an extensive investigation that culminated in a union-required hearing, a discharge hearing, wouldn't bring the supportive records. I mean, even in the Scarhosts and other cases that are precedential, you've had something other than hearsay to support the ULJ's findings.
Yeah, so we did just have the testimony. We have a copy of the termination letter, of course, but we do just have the testimony about the investigation, and the judge found that testimony to be reliable. Again, Relator could have requested to have copies of those records during the hearing, and the judge would have considered that request. The judge made that determination that she did not need those records. And
I don't know why Relator would request those records or subpoena that witness, who probably would be adverse to her.
Yeah. Yes. Well, if it would bolster the hearsay testimony, they could have requested those to
Deed could have done it.
I'm sorry?
Or
the ULJ could have done it. Yes, yeah, the ULJ could have done
employer.
It. There's under the law, there's nothing that requires the ULJ to request those documents, because the ULJ can rely on hearsay testimony if it meets that test for reliability. So adopting the relator's position would add a new rule. It would add a new burden for the ULJ in these hearings that they couldn't just rely on hearsay, that they would need to go through these extra steps, perhaps delay hearings, issue subpoenas. It would change the process. The ULJ is bound to, I mean, the ULJ must follow the rule that the hearsay is reliable, and the court has reversed when the ULJ has relied on hearsay testimony that's not reliable. So, I mean, that is a test that, you know, will kind of weed out hearsay that the judge shouldn't be relying on. But here the judge went through those steps of explaining, you know, her testimony is credible for these reasons. She was present in these thorough investigatory proceedings. She was present in the Loudermill hearing. And even though the Loudermill hearing may have occurred shortly after she was discharged, there was an investigation process that happened before she was discharged, where these same issues were being looked into. And
don't hearings normally take place that quickly? I don't know if you know either.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. I know sometimes they're not
that
quick.
That's just curiosity.
Yeah, yeah. But there was a whole investigation prior to her being discharged. So Relator was well aware of what the issue was and what the accusations were. And Relator had opportunities in the investigation to provide this explanation about the resident knocking the mask off. And she didn't do that in the investigation.
What are you saying? She knew it was coming and had the ability to prepare herself but didn't?
Well, if that had happened, she had the opportunity to explain that had happened in the investigation and in the hearing, and she didn't provide that as she never explained that's what happened, and that's part of why the judge found her to lack credibility. She, in the investigation and the hearing, she said that she forgot her goggles and she was defogging her mask, I believe is what she said, and she didn't say anything about a resident knocking it off. And also, the judge also found her testimony to lack credibility because in her answers to questionnaires, which are in the record, she says that she was wearing her mask, goggles, and face shield. So the judge found her testimony to lack credibility because it was inconsistent with what she said in the investigation in the hearing, and it was inconsistent with her answers to the questionnaires. So it is well settled. You know, the court has repeatedly cited this rule from the Vang case in 1985, that hearsay may be admissible and sufficient to support a ULJ's decision.
But Vang didn't present actual facts where it was exclusively hearsay.
That's right.
Evidence.
That's,
I mean,
right.
We don't have that case before. I mean, there aren't any precedential cases that I've been able to find.
Well, I would say Pitchler, you know, that first case from 1976. The only evidence, and some of these cases it's hard to parse, was there other evidence that the judge was looking at, because the it doesn't quite go through that exercise. But in Pitchler, you know, the court, you know, the only evidence,
the Supreme Court,
yes,
said that you don't have to follow the strict compliance with common law or statutory, but I mean, Would this not be on a case-by-case basis because it depends on the nature of the hearsay and how it's received and what our counter evidence there would be?
Yes, yes, I agree with you. It's hard to compare. In Pitchler, you know, a deed representative testified that about what an employer told her. And the court said that it was proper for the ULJ to receive that and rely on it. And after that case, that's when the Vang court and the Brunello court, which is also published, started citing Pitchler for that proposition, hearsay is admissible and sufficient. So I think the court read Pitchler to rely solely on that hearsay evidence, to say hearsay evidence is sufficient to support the decision. You don't need, you know, the other non-hearsay evidence as well. And so the court has quoted the rule in those words, is sufficient, you know, throughout the years. The court's never considered the residuum rule. And I was also kind of surprised to read through the case law and say, I don't think this is ever, the court's never directly addressed that, or it's never come up where the court's saying the residuum rule, you know, doesn't apply. But I think it's inconsistent with the case law that repeatedly says it was proper for the ULJ to rely on this hearsay testimony as long as it meets the test for reliability. So it would be a new rule, and it's inconsistent with the statute and the rule on evidence for unemployment benefits proceedings. I'll talk a little about the employment misconduct. So in general, refusing to abide by an employer's reasonable policies is employment misconduct. The court has also stated that this is particularly true in the field of healthcare, where violation of a policy could expose people to serious harm. And the case for that, when I was preparing, I noticed that my brief didn't have the correct citation. That's Russ versus Abbott Northwestern Hospital. So I apologize for that. But the evidence here does support that the relator's conduct was negligent, intentional, or indifferent. And this is the evidence that supports that. So Weiss testified that the facility was under strict COVID-19 precautions, and she described what the expectations were. Weiss testified that relator received training on that policy and that her supervisor discussed it with her personally. Weiss testified that it had been an issue before. The ULJ didn't specifically find that, but Weiss testified her supervisor had talked with her before about needing to wear the proper PPE. And relator admits that she was aware of that policy. She never says, I didn't understand it. She never says that wasn't the case. And then the ULJ found that her explanation about why she wasn't wearing that lacked credibility. So in light of all these facts, you know, relator either intentionally chose not to wear her face mask, or she violated a standard of care that she had been trained on and that she was aware of, and she offers no reason why she would have done that, no credible reason. So it is either intentional or it's negligent. She's breaching that duty to wear the proper PPE as directed by her supervisors, and she doesn't give any credible reason as to why she was doing that. So it is negligent, or perhaps intentional, or indifferent. There's no credible evidence that it was out of her control, you know, that she was unable to wear that face mask for whatever reason. So the evidence does support that it was intentional, negligent, or indifferent, which is the required standard under the statute for employment misconduct. Well, I believe that I've covered the points that I wanted to cover today. If there are no additional questions. Okay, thank you.
I'll conclude.
Yeah, thank you. We just request that the court affirm the decision of the ULJ. Thank you very much.
Mr. Knapp, you get the last word.
Before you start, can I ask you a question?
Yes,
and
you may.
The question is this. Ms. Phillips stood up and said that on the basis of your client admitting that she did not provide cares, that alone would be a basis to affirm. How do you respond to that?
That's not why she was terminated. And I think Ms. Weiss's testimony makes it clear that it was that final incident, that October 20th alleged infraction, that prompted the termination. They suspended her for the conduct she admitted to, but they didn't terminate her. The point that I want to emphasize is the residual rule isn't a new rule. This court recognized it in a precedential opinion in 1975. It's also not a rule of evidence. It doesn't monitor what may come in or what may stay out. It articulates an important principle of judicial review. Administrative decision-making in this state is all more or less eventually subject to judicial review. This principle says, as a first note to agencies, you're free to vary from our rules of evidence, but when you come for review, one of the things that we're going to expect to see is that there's something there that would have supported your findings that would have been admissible in a judicial proceeding. The legislature is free to tell us, no, this agency is excluded from that process, but that hasn't happened here. These cases are unusual, I think both counsel agree. The cases that we've seen where hearsay has been admitted and relied upon are cases where that hearsay was reliable and I submit would have been admissible in a judicial proceeding. It's unusual for a case like this to happen. We didn't expect it to happen. The student attorney who was handling this case came that day prepared to cross-examine a witness who had seen the incident so that we could establish, we hoped, that it was not the product of negligence. No such witness appeared. We certainly ought not have been charged with the burden of finding a witness who had seen the incident and bringing it, subpoenaing that witness into court, or getting production of the incident report or the investigation report and offering that ourselves. That would be a new requirement for this court to impose on claimants. This rule doesn't add something new to the ULJ's burden. It protects the ULJ. These cases are unusual. This court should not give blessing to these kinds of cases to make them more common. We don't want this ever to happen, and neither does the department, and neither should ULJs. They should have the evidence in front of them that is sufficient to come to some conclusion, not only about whether an infraction has occurred, but whether or not that infraction was negligent. And here, that evidence is not available because it wasn't provided by the employer. And so we request reversal and a precedential opinion applying the residual rule to the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well briefed and argued likewise.